docket in person, live and in person, is Medvedev versus Henrico County.
I think it's something Mr. Hargett is doing on Vegas Act.
Mr. Hargett and Mr. Lewis. Okay. Mr. Hargett, no stranger to our court. Welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good to be here again. If you were going to ask, I was going to reserve 3 minutes, or try to anyway, for rebuttal.
3 minutes? 3 minutes it is.
All right.
Anticipating my every word. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I represent, my name is David Hargett, and I represent Mr. Medvedev on the appeal of his DUI conviction. As the court is well aware, this case is very limited in the facts because this is a conditional guilty plea. So the only issue is the motion to suppress. And it's a fairly unique combination of facts, but it's, again, a very, very short record. I would say first and foremost that because the Commonwealth has conceded that Mr. Medvedev was seized at the moment that his license was obtained, then that issue has been resolved.
Well, if only. Because we're not bound by concessions of law, as you well know. We are bound by concessions of fact. So to the extent there's historical facts that they're involved in a seizure, then we're certainly bound by that. But whether that constitutes a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes, that's a concession that's not binding on the court, and we have to deal with it from a legal standpoint in any event, it seems to me.
Well, in some extent, but keep in mind, of course, that as the one who carries the burden of proof, it makes it much harder to argue against something that wasn't addressed at the trial level. And, of course, you know, we often have the dilemma of a lack of a contemporaneous objection, and we're arguing that before the court. But here it's kind of the opposite. I mean, the Commonwealth has accepted and agreed that the matter was resolved at that moment, that he was seized at that moment. And I understand that there are some other precedent out there, but the facts of this case are pretty simple. I mean, his license was taken, and then he was not. The question is, would a reasonable person believe that they could leave at that moment? And he is already with the officer. The officer takes his license and then does, apparently, according to the record, does nothing but sits and waits.
Well, counsel, but what's the difference when you stop a vehicle and take someone's license versus when someone is not behind the wheel of a car and you ask for the license and you take the license?
I don't believe that an ordinary citizen would know that there's any difference between the two.
That's not what the case law says, though.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but we're talking about what a reasonable person would believe. I mean, here, how could you be free to leave while the officer is holding your form of identification? I mean, I understand that it is different if you're behind the wheel, because technically you're supposed to have a license while you're driving. So that does make sense. But after all, he was detained until another officer arrived, and then the detention continued. And again, you know, I understand this is a legal analysis, but it's also a factual one. So the facts...
Right. There's a cart and a horse kind of thing here going on. So you have the officer's testimony, which shows some minor indiscrepancies in what the officer says at different times, but the bottom line is that the trial court found that it was essentially simultaneous that the officer smelled the alcohol and the driver's license was handed over, correct?
The judge did say simultaneous.
And
yes.
That's a factual finding, right?
That is a factual finding, that is correct.
Okay.
And it's supported by the officer's clarification in his testimony, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, yes. So the officer says it, I think, three different ways. He uses the word concurrent. He says, I can't say which happened first. And he says basically at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, you know, you can mince those words if you wanted to, but I don't think that's necessary. I think that on that...
Well, it's necessary from the standpoint of clearly there's reasonable suspicion at that point. I think even you would concede that, assuming there's a nexus between this individual and... The person who supposedly is operating this motor vehicle on the highway.
Well, I do not concede that, because a couple of points. One, there is no real connection to the vehicle that was...
Well, I was assuming. I said assuming.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, one of the problems I have with this record is there's a lot missing from this record, probably due to the fact that it was a conditional guilty plea and the evidence wasn't terribly well developed, it seems to me, but...
Right, and I feel the pain of that. I think both sides do a little bit. And I think you're right. So, yes, yeah, so there is no connection between the driver of the vehicle and Mr. Medvedev. There was apparently an assumption that the officer made that that must have been the guy. And that's not really, objectively reasonable. That's kind of what we would call a hunch. Now, it may have been a correct hunch, but it was a hunch.
Let me ask you this. Does the record establish whether the citizen's initial report was on the 911 system?
As opposed to
calling on a landline or something to that effect.
I believe it was referenced as a 911 call, but that hadn't even crossed my mind. I think so.
Okay.
I think, in fairness to both sides, I think it's referred to by the officer just as a dispatch recording, which I put two and two together and probably came up with 911.
Yeah, there's a couple of different.
It ain't necessarily so.
Okay.
There's a couple of different recordings discussed and
right, and to me that point is not very significant because again you have no connection between the vehicle, because keep in mind the only facts are the officer gets the information, he arrives to a point, he sees a car that matches the description and a person standing behind it, there's a little bit of a point and a nod, and then he drives on and then he parks his car, gets out and sees Mr. Medvedev sitting on a bench with a security officer standing in his presence. That's it. So as far as the driving, there is no connection there, and it's certainly not an ongoing activity as far as the driving is concerned.
But he could have gotten back, assuming that he was the driver of the vehicle, he could have gotten back in the vehicle and taken it and driven away.
But that would be true for anybody
right.
who's on the street. So
right. Well, with a car.
But you have to have a reason to believe that that's the case. He's sitting there on the bench. First of all, you don't know that it has his car. And there's no reason to suspect that it would be different if he was walking and sticks a key in the door and starts opening it.
Well, there's no question the Commonwealth, this is a conditional guilty plea again, so the Commonwealth doesn't have to do much. But from the standpoint, maybe this is a lesson for them to take to their colleagues. But I know it's a lesson you don't want them to learn, I suspect. But nonetheless, when we have these matters that come up in suppression hearings, the record needs to be as fully developed as would normally be in a trial situation. And we don't know, we could read between the lines, but, we have the security guard who's sitting there and apparently wouldn't let the guy retrieve a child because she felt that he was under the influence. And we have the officer who did nothing for 5 minutes after, acquiring your client's driver's license, but nobody's making any arguments under Rodriguez here about that. We've got we don't know how the officer knows that this particular individual is the driver versus the other individual who's present, who apparently is assumed to be the tipster. None of that is tied together. So, it's not helpful to us for either side in trying to parse this out. So it seems to me the starting point is there a seizure of your client? And if so, when did it take place? Did it take place when the driver's license was requested? And if that was simultaneous with the discovery that there's an odor of alcohol, then it seems to me you arguably got reasonable suspicion, which is going to entitle the officer to investigate as to whether he's the driver of this car that that the tipster reported. And then we have a Navarette, issue to resolve. If it's a consensual encounter, we don't need to do any of that because we have a consensual encounter and the Fourth Amendment isn't implicated. So, it seems to me that's where the rubber's meeting the road here, and we're trying to figure out which it is.
We feel your pain.
And I understand all that. And I think that if you back up and you look at it strictly from the standpoint of the simultaneous aspect of it, because that could be dispositive here. I do not believe that a simultaneous reason to stop someone is sufficient while you're stopping them. In other words, let's take it to a little more extreme.
But there was no stop.
Well,
the car was stopped. There was nobody's in the car. He's sitting on a bench somewhere, I guess, in the vicinity of the vehicle. But this is not a traffic stop situation.
I meant the seizure, the taking of the license.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. So let's assume the Commonwealth did not concede anything.
Okay.
Let's just, and that's the assumption. You're a good lawyer. I want you to follow this. So that's the assumption. And he's sitting on the bench, just everything the same way. And the officer goes over and introduces himself and says, "Could I see your license?" And he hands over the license. Is that a consensual encounter or a seizure? At that point.
That at that moment would most likely be consensual.
Okay, and then what happens afterwards could potentially turn into a seizure.
Walking away with your license, not giving it back, or just standing there, obviously waiting for another officer to arrive would be a seizure, yes.
Okay. Well, at some point, I don't know where the line would be drawn at some point, but I think we'd all agree that a consensual encounter could be converted into a Fourth Amendment seizure situation.
And we're also limited to some extent by what the court ruled. I would hope so for an appeal. So the court did rule that at that moment it was simultaneous, the probable cause, and he pointed back to a few of the facts regarding the tip, but also the smell of alcohol and the standing funny as being reasonable, articulable suspicion. I would argue that those two factors really aren't enough alone without observing.
I didn't see anything approaching probable cause anywhere in here.
Right.
Reasonable suspicion is a different story, though.
Right, and as far as the simultaneous aspect, because I didn't put this in the brief, but I think that it's important to kind of look at it from the context of another hypothetical. Let's suppose, for instance, an officer goes and tackles somebody that he sees, and while tackling him, he notices he has a gun tucked in the back of his pants. Right, so simultaneously, he has a reason for detaining him, but he's clearly detaining him when that's happening. I don't think that's how the law was set up to work. I think you need to first have it materialize in the officer's mind, reasonably objectable officer.
But when you're tackling, it's not a consensual encounter. But when you're, I mean, the old, I mean, Mendenhall, the old walk up to the dude, say, "Hey, mind if I ask you a couple questions? Can I have your identification or your license? Sure, let me look at it." I mean, all of that is very different from, I'm going to see if a police officer tackles somebody and then see a gun.
Right. But
I was pointing
to the simultaneous nature of it.
Right.
Now,
okay,
if you don't believe that he was being seized at all at that moment, then, of course, the hypothetical might not work as well. but we're operating under the concession that the Commonwealth made with no additional facts that were developed or surrounding that. I mean, clearly there could have been a motion to reconsider the motion to suppress.
Yeah, this is not a perfect world for you. We get that.
This could have been handled any number of different ways, but we're left with what we have. And with that, if you don't mind, unless there are additional questions to address, I'd be happy to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Okay. Mr. Lewis, it's now time for you to answer some tough questions.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'll start off with some.
Oh, let him introduce himself. He's
okay.
Brand new to the court.
He's
not even from the Attorney General's office. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
May it please the court, I'm Jeremy Lewis on behalf of the county, the appellee. And Judge Humphreys, I'll defer to your questions.
The problem here, of course, is the concession.
Yes, sir.
And you conceded. There's no question you conceded the point. The question for us is, and we're certainly not bound by concessions of law. And I guess my initial question is simply, where does that leave us? Because given the argument I just heard from Mr. Hargett, but for the concession, we wouldn't probably be having any kind of a discussion about Navarette or anything else.
Yes, sir, and I agree, and I'm in the less than desirable position of being in front of your honors and asking you to not go along with what the concession was at the trial court. And I believe there's precedent for that, as you've referenced, it's Tuggle versus Commonwealth, Wright versus Commonwealth, that this court is not bound by concessions of law at trial. And my argument that I would submit to you is that a Fourth Amendment seizure is a concession or is a question of law, and that question of law then can be revisited by your honors. And with that being said, if that concession is revisited and if that concession, then we are looking at this as whether it was a seizure at the time that the operator's license was requested from the appellant, then we have Branham versus Commonwealth, which may have been the case that we're all thinking of. That is the case that says that absent a signal to stop, a request for an operator's license is not a seizure. And that's the case that we have here. The record is, for all of its holes, is clear that there was not a signal to stop, that the officer pulled up, parked his car, there are no lights, there are no sirens, there's no display of a weapon, no displays of other officers in any type of form there was no signal to stop. He approaches the individual on the bench, who is the appellant, and asks him to step over to his car and then request his operator's license.
Well, in terms of holes in the record, assuming we were to get to basically be stuck with your concession and have to do an Navarette analysis, one of the holes I see here is there seems to be this implication in the record that's silent but taken by everybody, including the trial court, that the tipster is the other person other than the security guard who's in the vicinity when the police officer arrives, which seems to me to put a very different spin on the anonymous tipster body of law, because we've got cases from our court that if the tipster makes themselves available, even if they're not known to the police, that's an issue of reliability that's part of the Fourth Amendment analysis. But again, we don't have that information in the record, although it seems to be one that was inferred at least by everyone in the courtroom that day, but the three of us weren't in the courtroom that day, and we're stuck with what is presented to us in this limited form of the suppression hearing record.
Yes, sir. I think that I would agree with you that there is no direct statement by the officer that was the individual that called in and that he was aware at the time when he saw this individual who was standing over there and motioned to the appellant who was sitting on the bench.
In fact, this officer doesn't even know what the call was. This officer did not even hear any information he couldn't recall any of the information that was given to him by dispatch other than this guy was all over the road, right?
Right, so he knows
the vehicle.
Yes, he knows that there was a call in of a driver who was behind a red Mazda SUV, who was calling in at the time and following behind that red Mazda SUV, and the two specific instances of driving conduct that are alleged to dispatch and then relate to him, the officer, are that the car was all over the road and swerving off the road. And so that's the information that he knows. And I would submit that if the court does find that there was a seizure and we're now at the time of the seizure, was there a reasonable articulable suspicion for that seizure analysis, that does fall under Navarette. That we have, in Navarette, the court held that, or there was, the instance was there was a 911 caller about a DUI who had called through a dispatch system.
Do we
system.
Even have that in the record, that this is a 911 call?
No, we do not. I think that is another item that is assumed because we have a dispatch call,
yeah,
but the word 911.
You were the prosecutor.
I was.
In this case. You played the recording for the court. You didn't bother to introduce his exhibit. We don't have a transcription of it, and we don't have the exhibit. So we got nothing.
And if I may, I was not the one that played the recording. It was the defense attorney. But yes, the recording was not actually played or submitted at all.
That makes sense because it's your obligation.
Who was also not Mr. Hargett.
I understood. So we are all, yes. And I understand the holes in the record.
You're the only one that was actually there. So we're going
to... And I understand I'm taking the blame for everyone, and probably rightfully should. But I'm going to submit to your honors that even... in with this that we're at now, even with the holes in the record, even if we're at the point where I'm going to argue that this was not a seizure, but if we are at the point where this was a seizure at the time that the operator's license is being handed over, that we still have reasonable articulable suspicion. There's no argument that we have probable cause. The argument is that there is reasonable articulable suspicion.
Well, unfortunately, though, the judge went off on probable cause, so.
But I think the problem is a lot of judges and lawyers too use those terms interchangeably.
Yeah.
They're not interchangeable, clearly.
So let me ask you this. What actually is in the record relating to the communication from citizen, listen to me now, okay? Citizen to dispatcher. Dispatcher to officer, not officer one, but officer two, who's the only one that testified at the motion to suppress, which is another problem.
The actual information that was...
What information do we know is in the record?
In the record, so if we look at on the appendix of pages 37 through 39, the officer, Officer Phillips, who's testifying, on page 35, that's when he says what was relayed to him from dispatch is being relayed to him from the caller. And that is that there was an individual who's driving on the road. He is behind a red Mazda SUV. And that red Mazda SUV is, quote, all over the road and swerving off the road. And that's the extent of the information that he has when he gets there. And then when he gets there, he sees a red Mazda SUV in the parking lot that he's directed to report to. And then he sees the individual seated on the bench after he sees some individual that he assumes that is the tipster. But that is never corroborated by him at any point in the evidence on the
record. And we don't know, other than Mr. Hargett's concession here today and the one at the trial, we don't know that it was actually a 911 dispatch call.
Correct. The term 911 is never used in court. It is just that it was a call through dispatch that then was relayed to the officer.
Call through dispatch.
Correct.
Okay.
So the term 911 is not ever used,
okay,
but it is a call through dispatch.
Through dispatch. Okay.
That then is relayed to the officer.
Well, that's kind of significant, isn't it? Because Navarrete. A number of other U.S. Supreme Court cases that distinguish, for example, even Sixth Amendment cases, talk about the fact that 911 calls have an additional layer of reliability because they are emergency calls by their very nature.
Right. So, and this is where I would say that even without the exact term 911, the dispatch call still satisfies the reasons why they are given the extra indicia of reliability.
It would be a reasonable inference from the fact that it said through dispatch.
I would agree with that, and I would agree that is a reasonable inference. And I would also say that even if your honors are not willing to go to that point, the courts in Navarrete and then with other court cases with 911 calls have said that the 911 calls have a higher indicia of reliability because they are contemporaneous and because there is also the potential to track the, quote, anonymous or semi-anonymous tipster. And I would submit that the dispatch call can provide for those same concerns. The driver or the person who's calling in through the 911 call is saying, I'm behind this car and these are the observations that I'm making. It's a contemporaneous report. And it's even more contemporaneous than Navarrete. Navarrete was an individual who was run off the road, then was sitting on the side of the road after it had already happened and called to report it. And I think in Navarrete it was a couple minutes afterwards. Here we have a call into dispatch that is, I am currently observing this as it has happening and I'm calling you. In addition to that, the call into dispatch, the county would submit also can provide for the same kind of reliability that the 911 call based on the contemporaneous nature,
well,
but
right.
Also the...
It would have even been more reliable in this case had the record reflected that this particular tipster apparently followed the individual to the Jewish Community Center and waited for the police to arrive while there. Had that been in the record, and that's, as I say, it's sort of implied, but it's not explicit.
And I am along with you in wishing the evidence had come out that way as well, Your Honor.
Well, hindsight's always 20/20. I was once in your position, so I know what it's like.
Is it a reasonable inference from the record, from what we do have in the record, is it a reasonable inference that when the officer arrived and there's a dude standing in the parking lot, officer sees him, he nods, when the officer points over there, is it a reasonable inference that's the tipster?
I would submit that it is a reasonable inference. It's a reasonable inference when the officer arrives there based on a call from dispatch that directs him to this place where a red Mazda SUV is going to be parked by an individual or driven by an individual who's being followed by another individual. The officer gets to that location and is then directed in some, granted, ambiguous way to direct his attention towards the individual sitting on the bench. All of those things correspond with the officer's expectations from the dispatch call when he arrives there. The other thing that I would bring up is that if we're at that this was a seizure at the time, there's also an alternative. There's an alternative crime that we can be developing reasonable suspicion or probable cause for that is occurring at the time. So Navarrete, or one of the arguments by the appellant, is only applies to ongoing crimes. This DUI may have been already completed at the time. The Commonwealth would submit that the line of cases that limits reasonable articulable suspicion or Terry stops after the completion of a crime to only being felonies, the United States, Henley, and et cetera, kind of outlines the reason why we have that concern of not wanting to stop people after a completed crime, and that's pushing it towards just a felony is because the felony is a more serious crime. We want it to, we want things to be ongoing because at that point the officers have less time to kind of conduct their investigation. Well, and once the crime is committed.
One of the problems with that position in this particular case is here this officer did nothing. He basically shows up, gets the license, and hangs around waiting for another officer to get there. Now, nobody's raised the Rodriguez argument in this case, but had they, I think that probably is pretty fatal to this, you know, your position in this case, because you're frankly required by law to actually pursue the investigation that you have reasonable suspicion for. You can't just do nothing and not have a Fourth Amendment violation.
Assuming that there was a seizure at the time and the issue was brought up, yes, that could have been an issue for the Commonwealth.
Well, and as Mr. Hargett, you know, argued, and I agree with him, frankly, that even a consensual encounter can become a seizure at some point. You take the guy's license consensually, or you ask him a few questions. If you're not going to, if enough time goes by, you don't give it back. He can't obviously legally get behind the wheel and drive away, even if he wants to, as long as you retain that license. At some point, it seems to me a reasonable person would feel seized.
And if that's the case, and the Commonwealth would submit that this amount of time has not, so we have in the record it was 3 to 5 minutes, the Commonwealth would submit that is not amount of time for that to come to fruition and to be in a seizure. And alternatively to this, we've been talking about this in terms of reasonable suspicion for a DUI or seizing the individual on a DUI. There's also the specter out there of this, so the reasonable suspicion is an objective standard. And despite the fact that the officer may have had in his head that this was a DUI, there's also, I would submit, reasonable suspicion for a drunken public. So we have all of the same information that the officer had for the DUI, but now just applied to an individual who, as the record is clear, is out on the front bench on a sidewalk in front of the Jewish Community Center, which is a public building. So we have the same information, but now we are applying it to, if never, it does require an ongoing crime, the ongoing crime of being drunk in public. Granted, it's a Class 4 misdemeanor, but it is still a misdemeanor crime.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hart.
Yes, I don't believe that I conceded that it was 911 call. I think I said that I assumed it was, but I didn't know what you were talking about. I thought you were talking about the initial call that was made, and I think that's an assumption that I can make, but it's not necessarily.
It's an inference from the through dispatch.
Yeah, I'm not sure how else you contact the police when you're following a car down the road, but I didn't want to concede something that might ultimately be important.
Well, I think your opponent bailed you out on that one because he conceded that no one ever referred to it as a 911 call.
And that's correct. I was looking through the record myself. And the other language that was used was not only all over the road, it was also suspected drunk driving. Now, whether that was stated by the caller...
Wasn't that his conclusion based on... what he remembered from dispatch?
It's hard to say if he was saying that that's what was said or if that's what he thought based on what dispatch told him. But the suspected drunk driver part is there. But again, I don't think that you even need to worry about the tip because you don't have anything that says this is the guy that was driving the car. There's simply nothing. I think that the record doesn't even come close to suggesting that the tipster pointed out the driver.
Isn't it a reasonable inference from the facts in the record that when the officer arrived and he saw the guy standing in the parking lot, and from the officer's testimony, it's a reasonable inference that in some way the guy acknowledged that the guy on the bench was the person in the Mazda?
Absolutely not. You cannot go that far. The only communication was the thumbs up or the pointing and the eye contact had to do with the vehicle. It was a point toward the vehicle. So the officer points to the vehicle. The person standing beside the vehicle does this.
Right.
That's it. And by this, I mean nods his head up and down.
Right.
So I don't think that there's any inference you can make from that. As a matter of fact, reasonable inference isn't even the test here. The question is whether the officer had suspicion that was reasonable or whether he made a hunch or
assumption. Let's assume it was just a total hunch at that point.
Yes.
When he walks up to your client and asks for the license and simultaneously detects the odor of alcohol, why isn't at that instant reasonable suspicion to pursue an investigation or something?
Well, because you can't have them simultaneous. You have to have the reasonable suspicion and then detain the person. And I disagree that he was simply asked for his license. As a matter of fact, he went over to the gentleman sitting on the bench. He said, and we don't know the words that were used because it was conceded that it was a seizure when he took the license, but he asked him to walk over.
The evidence of light most favorable to Colville, I'm looking at pages 38 and 39 of the joint appendix. Sir, would you join me over by my car? Then the officer says he didn't recall the appellant making a, quote, verbal reply, but he walked over and stood in front of the officer's car. Then Phillips then asked the appellant if he had his driver's license with him, and appellant produced his license. That's on page 39. At about the same time Officer Phillips asked for the license, he detected an odor of alcoholic beverage about the appellant. Now, if I take that literally, in the light most, that's on page 40 of the joint appendix. If I take that literally, that record reflects that at about the same time Officer Phillips asked for the license, as opposed to actually receiving the license, he detected an odor of alcohol. So, I mean, it seems to me if we're going to split hairs, the way you split the hair, the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, is that he actually detected the odor of alcohol before he actually received the license, because he detected it as he asked for the license.
Well, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think you can get off the hook that easy.
The simultaneous nature of it is what's key here, because there's no question that there's a discussion of contemporaneous or concurrent. But the officer clearly says he doesn't know which one happens first. He gets the license, or he notices the alcohol. He can't say that which happens first. And so you can't just assume that that's what happened. And again, if that's the moment of the seizure, he's already asked him over to the car, and now he's asking him to produce his license, and he takes it from them. I would say that, you know, you might be splitting hairs, but we don't have a record that's quite detailed enough for us to be able to do that hair splitting here. And I think that because...
Well, but any of that goes, at this juncture, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth on factual determinations.
Well, but...
Facts in the
record. You've already made it in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth to say that it happened at the same time. Now, so then you're going to now say that, well, now we can get to decide what happened at the same time?
No, we asked you that.
Well,
that
was... Well, but it did happen at the same time, but I don't know which came first, and the officer even says he doesn't know.
If he detected the odor of alcohol before he actually received the license, even assuming that's a seizure when he received the license, then it seems to me an argument is a valid argument can be made that at that point he's got reasonable suspicion to pursue an investigation for something, doesn't he?
Well, he doesn't have any reason to believe that he's intoxicated. He never says that he
did. Odor of alcohol, just the odor of alcohol. If he believes that he's the driver of that red car, subjectively, for whatever reason, whether it's from the tipster or whatever, isn't he entitled to pursue an investigation as to whether or not he is, in fact, you know, not that he's had some alcohol to drink, but that he's impaired and that he was driving a car?
Well, he'd already seen him walk over to the police cruiser. So there was nothing, and he says, I think three times in the record, the officer says, I never saw anything that led me to any other suspicion whatsoever. So the sheer moment that he gets a whiff of alcohol, whether he thinks it's coming from them or whether it's coming from the breeze, I mean, I don't know how you can make that determination in the same instant that somebody's handing you a license and be able to say, and that's why I seized him. If that was a seizure, that's why I seized him. I don't think that's reasonable.
Okay. Well... Thank you, Mr. Harger. We sort of took up your time. I'll give you a minute to conclude if you... But based on the look on your face, you don't want a minute.
I appreciate that. I greatly do. Okay. I really do.
He's well, swinging more than he has to.
In all seriousness to both of you, you know, the court wouldn't give you all these questions if we weren't really trying to get to the bottom of things, and you both did an excellent job. We appreciate your advocacy for your respective clients. And now we'll come down off the bench.